Welcome to a special Aspen Public Radio broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. I'm Marcy Grivenin. On Thursday, actor Goldie Hawn spoke with Michael Eisner, a trustee with the Aspen Institute. Corporate support for Aspen Public Radio's coverage of the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival broadcasts comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisory firm that works with individuals, corporations, and foundations with offices in Aspen and Denver. More at obermeyerwood.com. Goldie Hawn is a Harmon Eisner artist in residence. In this talk, she speaks about her career and the work she continues to support through the Hawn Foundation, which takes up as its mission the needs of children. The foundation uses mindfulness to help young people develop social and emotional intelligence and in turn reduce the distress and distraction at school that can lead to increased dropout rates. Here are Goldie Hawn and Michael Eisner. Damian Wetzel of the Aspen Institute's Arts Program introduces them.
In today's discussion, I'm very pleased to present, first of all, my friend Michael Eisner, who really is, you know, the founding father of arts at the Aspen Institute in this generation. With Sidney Harmon, he created the Harmon Eisner Artists in Residence Program in the firm belief that arts need to be a part of the larger conversation. That it is not enough simply to like the arts, perhaps go to the arts, but that the arts should have a voice in everything that we talk about when we're looking for progress and also for who we are as people overall. Sidney was a passionate believer in this, and he really is, you know, the energy that started this with Michael just over 10 years ago. So it's a pleasure to have Michael here on the stage in discussion with our 2015 Harmon Eisner Artist in Residence, Goldie Hawn. Goldie needs very little introduction, an Academy Award-winning actress, producer, director, best-selling author, and all of that speaks to her artistic excellence and all of the work that she did, and it is work. I always like to remind people it's not just kind of fun, it's hard work. But her work has extended to the development of emotional intelligence, social development in children and education through her Mind Up Foundation, which we'll hear more about. And given our work in education at the Aspen Institute and my own work on the President's Committee for Arts and Humanities, I can think of no better person I could see in conversation on this topic with Michael. So please welcome Michael Eisner and Goldie Hawn.
Thank you. So this will be fun. Goldie is fantastic. But here's the interesting thing. When Sidney and I, and particularly Sidney, started the Harmon Eisner Artist in Residence, and we've had a variety of fantastic people. And this year, for those of you who saw JR or Cameron Carpenter, the fantastic organist, or when Damian was an artist in residence, or Julie Taymor, and many of the artists in residence that we've had, we see really early. We see when they're just being discovered, when they've been doing art on the streets of Paris, where they're, well, Damien was further along. I saw his last performance at the New York Ballet, which is the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen. And he then went to Harvard and became a suit. But before that, I saw him. And I'm so happy that we have an artist in residence who has done all that. I saw Goldie Hawn, she doesn't even know this, but in 1964, she was a can-can dancer at the World's Fair at the Texas Pavilion.
You did not see me.
I did see you. I think I saw you. I was there about 11 times, and you were there, and I went to the Texas Pavilion, and you were doing that thing.
Oh, my God.
So you have here a artist whose mother had a dance studio, grew up in the middle, well, the eastern middle of the country, around Baltimore, so it's, I guess, at the east. Who father was a violinist, and this has been kind of consistent now with people I've been interviewing, that whose one parent was, you know, Cameron Carpenter's mother was a artist. You see a lot of the people who become artists have this unbelievable influence from their parents. So I think let's start that way. What influence did your parents have on you you know, being a dancer, growing up wanting to be a dancer, obsessed to be a dancer.
I started when I was 3. My mother was opening a dancing school, and I was 3 years old at that time, and Roberta was my dance teacher. It was right next to the shop that my mom owned, because we were shop owners. We had a gift shop, and we had a watch shop, and that's how I started. And I danced because my mother told me to.
But you liked it.
I loved it. You know, it was a big part of my life for all my life. I danced from all, you know, 3-4 times a week till I was 19 when I auditioned for the Texas Pavilion in Washington, D.C., and I came back home and I said to Mom and Dad, I got the job. My father's a musician, so there was a lot of DNA, okay? My mother should have been the movie star. She was truly a light. She was a huge personality. She was a singer. I heard a lot of things about my mom, about her in her youth. So she really was the performer. And I think that we get it by just not osmosis, but I think we also have that sort of gene in our DNA. I would dance in the room. I would entertain friends. I would do imitations of my sister in front of her boyfriends. I mean, I was not... She was so mad at me, but I couldn't help it because I would see the way she would hold herself and how she'd walk down the stairs and how she'd throw. And I got all this. My mother said to me, stop it. And I said, Mom, but it's so funny. So, and I was about 10. So, you know, I think it was in my blood.
So then you go and you join the world of dance. You go, you do the World's Fair. But then you end up doing that hard part of getting established. You're dancing in bars, you're dancing in, I don't mean topless bars, but bars.
Some of them were topless, but I wasn't.
And you saw kind of the lower life of what a lot of artists have to go through in their evolution to become a real artist.
Right. I just want to say something first, is that I had a dream. And I had a dream that I was going to be a dancer. And it's all I ever wanted to do. I wanted to dance. I wanted to be on Broadway. I wanted to go home. I wanted to open a dancing school. I wanted to get married. I wanted to have children. And I wanted to be happy. And these were the things that I really wanted to do. That was my life plan. People used to say to me, what do you want to be when you grow up, Goldie? And I said, happy. That's what I used to say. Happy. And I was 11 years old, because to me, that's what I wanted. I wanted a good life. I wanted a happy life. Why at the age of 11, I would think that would be an important aspiration, but I did. It wasn't like, what do you want to do? It's what do you want to be? So what I want to do...
If your mother named you Goldie, she must have thought that was a good idea, a good life goal. I mean,
no,
anybody named Goldie has to be happy.
Hold on. A matter of fact, my very first movie was at Disney Studios.
Yes.
It was the one and only genuine original family band. I went for the audition. This is an interesting story. I was lost on Dopey Drive. I then went to find the place to audition with my bag and my tights and my thing, and I went up to a woman, and I said to her, excuse me, but where is stage 42 or whatever? She said, oh, I'll take you. So she took me to stage 42. I end up getting the job. I just was going to be a dancer. I got the lead job, okay? I was so excited. They sent me the script. The script, I could not find my part. It was the giggly girl. I looked at it over and over again, and I realized I didn't have any lines. That I was just the lead dancer from Leslie Ann Warren. In the meantime, there was a man who was there, a young boy, really, playing in the show. He was in the band, and that was Kurt Russell. And he was 16. And I was much too old for him. But he was really cute. It turns out...
He was, by the way, Walt's favorite actor.
Yes.
In all those early Disney movies, Kurt Russell was the star. He was going to be a professional baseball player.
Yes, right, right. And he got a contract at Disney when he was young. As you know, Kurt started when he was 9 years old acting. And so that was his world. In the meantime, I find out that the woman, when I met Kurt years later, the woman that I went up to was Kurt's mother.
Really?
Yes. And when she came home that night and she said, I met the girl who's going to get the part.
Wow.
In the meantime, Anderson, was it? Okay? He called me in. Now, mind you, I was 20 years old. And he called me into his office. He was a producer.
Right.
And he called me into the office, or head of production, whatever. And he said, look, Goldie, I'm getting back to your question.
What? No, not Kurt Anderson. Go on. Sorry.
Okay, okay. So anyway, he said to me, we've really been discussing your billing for the movie. And we think that your name sounds like a stripper. So we were wondering if you were going to change your name, perhaps, for the show. So if you were going to change your name, then what would that be? And I said, Bill Anderson, or was it?
Bill Anderson.
Okay. Yeah. I said,
Oh, wow.
How about that?
By the way, she's smart as hell. Just so you're just going to tell you this right away. And Woody Allen, in commenting on Goldie, at the height of her silliness, laugh, and socket to me, said, nobody can do that who's not smart. You can't pull off being a blonde, giggly blonde, and not be smart. Otherwise, you're kind of silly. Anyway, so what are they?
So I said, I'm sorry. I said, my mother gave me that name because it belonged to my great aunt who raised my mother. Therefore, I will never change my name. I said, my name will not make me. I will make my name. So if you would like to use my middle name, which is Jean, and bill me as Goldie Jean Hahn, then I'll accept that.
And did they do that?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was 20 and I'm already negotiating. I couldn't believe it.
The only other person I ever heard do that is I was having a meeting with Mary Steenburgen and Barry Diller.
Yeah.
On our first movie with Jack Nicholson, and Barry said, her first movie, I think you have to change your name. And she said, I will when you do.
Ooh.
And I thought that was like
I love that.
Crawled into the thing.
So anyway, in the terms of the name and all of that stuff, sometimes we're named correctly. And even though I didn't have any hair when I was born, so my mom couldn't say, oh, she has blonde curly hair, I'm named Goldie. I was named for my aunt, and therefore my name really was an appropriate name, I think.
So when you are dancing and you're spotted in New York,
yeah,
and you end up on a one quick television show and then Laughing, where mm-hmm. everything erupted,
mm-hmm.
did that change your life, or did that send you in a direction that you were not happy with?
Right. So the trajectory there is, this is after my boyfriend that I met there at the Texas Pavilion, and this is after he, he was a bartender, so I used to ride with Jilly, who you remember was Frank Sinatra's bodyguard, but he had Jilly's, which was in New York, right next to my apartment. So I used to drive with this guy, Patty, who owned the bar, and I was, in the jump seat, and I thought, I wonder why we're going to Jilly's, and who knew? In the meantime, it turns out that I lived in the apartment next door, and that was the time when we had the blackout. So I lived in New York during the blackout, and at that time, it was an extraordinary time in New York City, because there was no crime, lots of babies were birthed and born, and I was preparing to do my first television show, and that was the Ed Sullivan Show, and I got asked to do that show, and I did it with Killer Joe Pirro, and I was one of the dancers. So that was one of the shows that my mom and dad were going, oh my God, she's on the Ed Sullivan Show, I can't believe it, when are you coming on? If they can see me. And of course, it was such a big deal.
You did not run away from home, which is the cliche story of actresses going to New York or going to Los Angeles. You actually would have preferred to stay home.
When I waved goodbye to my mom and dad when I was driving to New York with some driver that my mom knew and I didn't, I waved, but I never thought I wasn't ever going to come back again. I mean, to me, if I'd have known that that was the last time I'd ever go home, I wouldn't have gone.
What did you do in Ed Sullivan?
This.
By yourself?
No, I was in a chorus.
Oh.
But, that was the beginning. I was touching my toe in show business. In the meantime, I was dancing on pedestals for $25 a night. And that was so I could make my rent money, right? So that's how we got. And I did a few auditions. I did one audition for On a Clear Day. that I got right down to the bottom. And you know, Herb Ross, who was a very big director and a very big choreographer, lived with my mother, his sister, during the war. And so when they, my mom had a home, you know, she had a, what do you call it, a boarding house in Washington, D.C., which is where we lived. And so he, his sister and him lived in the boarding house. And he'd fly through the living room and he was a dancer and a thing. So she said to me, honey, call Herbie. Let him know that you're Goldie, you're Laura Hahn's daughter. And when you go to the audition, make sure you let him know. And I could never do that. So I then, at the end, Nora Kay and were sitting there. And I went up and I said, by the way, you didn't choose me, which is okay. I said, but I just want to let you know I'm Laura Hahn's daughter. Many years later, as life would have it in our business, he was chosen to do Protocol. So he directed a movie that I was in. And that was like just an amazing story of how, you know, a life is like a grid. And you never know who you're going to meet along the way, how things are going to work, and why you meet them. And sometimes life presents. That's why.
Well, just us being here together, we were doing a movie at Paramount called Foul Play. And we were offered Goldie Hawn. This was a big deal at Paramount. She was at the, nobody was, I mean, probably the biggest star in the world at this point. And I said to the agent, I hear she's heavy. And he said, I said, now don't say anything to her, but somebody told me she's heavy. And he said, well, look, I'll tell you what we'll do. He thought that was really a bad question. He said, we'll have a meeting and you can see for yourself, and then we don't have to deal with it. So Goldie's agent and Goldie show up in my office. She sits down and she said, so you think I'm heavy? Maybe one of the worst moments of my career. Oh my God. And then you said, don't you know what it's like when a woman has a baby? Come on. Now, I think I'd had a baby by then, so
you
I knew.
You did have a baby. Our kids
no, and the other age. Time, as long as we're reminiscing here, oh my God, this is, here, I'm with Goldie, I made the biggest mistake of my career. So I read a script called Private Benjamin. Well, no, wait a second. It's not a happy story for me. It's a happy story for her. So I read the script, and there's a great opening scene, which the lady you saw, Albert Brooks, dying at the wedding, and just a fantastic movie. And imagine Goldie Hawn looking the way she does and the way she did in a uniform. I mean, how can you miss? But I read the script, and I didn't think there was a third act. Arrogant English major thought there was no third act. I didn't think, oh, Goldie Hawn in a uniform, you don't need a third act. Who cares? So I meet Goldie and again a bunch of people, and I'm saying, you know, I don't think there's a third act, like, you know, pedantically. And they said, oh, yeah, really? Well, that's interesting. We'll take that into advice. Thank you very much, Mr. Suit. And 2 hours later, they made the deal at Columbia.
No, we made the deal at Warner's.
Warner Brothers?
Yeah.
Ivan Reitman, no?
No. It was
oh, that's right.
George Shapiro.
That's right. That's right. Well, I once that happened, I went into a deep depression. And it didn't matter. So from, you know, from Can-Can to Foul Play to Private Benjamin, which doesn't even include, obviously, Academy Award and Cactus Flower. Now, Cactus Flower was like your second movie, right? Really early
first,
movie.
It was my first real movie. The only other movie I did was with Kurt. You know, I did one on Jenny.
This was a starring vehicle, and you wouldn't even. How did you know at that age that you refused to audition? As I recall.
No.
He said, "I know." You said, "I know." They know who I am. Take me or don't take me.
Well, that could have been my manager that did that.
See, the rumors.
Yeah.
The rumor mill in Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't do that. I think that he did that. He thought a meeting would be better than that. The other thing that happened with
you exploded in that moment.
Was like, yeah, well, then that was after Laugh-In.
Right.
So Laugh-In already, that's where the explosion really happened. Because television is so powerful, right? And when I went on to do Laugh-In, I went from Good Morning World, which was the first TV series thing I ever did, pulled out of the chorus, literally. Agents saw me dancing with 12 other girls. I was doing the Andy Griffith Show and you know, Tennessee Ernie Ford and Don Knotts, okay? The best guys ever. And now I'm dancing.
You're dancing in the background. You're not like...
No, I'm a chorus girl.
Right.
12 chorus girls. And just to show you how no money I had, my tennis shoes had holes in them. So Tennessee Ernie Ford took up a collection and got me enough money to get new tennis shoes. So that's where I was in life. This guy says to me, what do you, you know, you have an agent. And I said, no, I don't, la, la, la. And I wasn't too trustful of men, especially who said, well, come on over here, I'll give you whatever. So I didn't follow up, but he said, come and see me. I'm at William Morris on Wednesday. I didn't do it, okay? So I get a call, and say, we're waiting for you, Ms. Hahn, Mr. Do-do-do, we have our agents here. And I went, oh, my God. So I get into my car, okay, which was a 54 Ford. It had no floor. So I had a hole in the floor, and every time I made a right-hand turn, I'm not kidding, the left-hand door flew open because it didn't have a latch. So I had to hold the door, turn the thing, and, of course, I had totally surround view. But anyway, I pulled in, and that's where I was signed at William Morris. The next day, I went to an audition. Bill Persky and Sam Donoff wrote a part in for me that didn't exist in this TV show. And it yanked me out of the course, out of my dream, out of the things I really wanted to do, and I know it sounds crazy. And you asked me a question earlier. And the question was, how did it feel when you suddenly became someone and you came out of the course? I was very anxious. I wasn't happy. I had anxiety attacks. I wanted to go home. I wanted to have a normal life. I always thought that movie stars and people were screwed up. And I didn't want to be like that. I wanted more normalcy in my life, even though my dad said to me, you're not normal.
Well, so, didn't you... So you told me once that you were, you know, during the Cold War, you were scared of the Russians coming.
And... Yeah, I was afraid because of all the propaganda they were doing with those kids. And a lot of the reasons why we'll talk later why I'm doing what I'm doing today. But in terms of that, I was afraid. I was really traumatized by that. So in terms of what happened to me there was like a whole other issue. And I realized that my life then was never going to be the same. That is when Billy Wilder called Mike Frankovich, who was at one point the head of all of Columbia in the UK, and now is an independent producer, and he was producing Cactus Flower. And he was called by Billy. And Billy said, you better, sorry to be speaking about me, but I'm telling the story. So he said, you better get that girl, because she's going to be a big star, and she would be perfect for that movie. That's really how that happened. So when you know, Mike called, it was to call me in because of Billy.
But so meteoric, you go from Can-Can and in cages and, I mean,
dancing, yeah, cages. I was in cages.
Dancing,
oh my
cages.
God. That's another book.
Is that are men as disgusting in those places as they?
Yeah.
They are. And how about the? I, by the way, this is for the record. Never in 40 years was I ever offered a bribe, a favor, a date, or anything.
Yeah.
So to me, I never saw any of that.
Yeah.
But that exists in Hollywood where you go for an interview and people have other ideas, or is that just a fantasy?
You don't know my story.
I'm going to hear it now.
Okay, I'm going to make it very short. So I'm walking across the street. I was in New York for 1 month. I'm walking across the street. A guy says to me, hi, my name is Peter Gale. I know you don't know me. He was 26 years old. He looked like a nice Jewish guy. He had a nice little watch on. He said, I'm not trying to put a make on you. Actually, to tell you the truth, I go with Tuesday Weld. Here it is. See here. I love you, Tuesday, on it. I'm looking at it. I'm going to a bathing suit audition. Then I'm going to the World's Fair, which I was dancing, right? Can-Can. So he said to me, wait here. I just got to tell you, you look like a character that was created in an Al Capp show called Tenderleaf Erickson. You would be perfect because you're interesting looking. You know, and I thought, yeah, I'm glad he didn't say I was beautiful because I wasn't. I just thought I was interesting looking. He hit it on the nail. So he then gets his car. He said, let me pick you up. Next thing I know, I'm in this fabulous green, Cadillac. And the top was down. And I'm like 1 month in New York going, oh, this is such a nice guy. Everything's good. And now drops me off, he picks me up, and then, you know, let's face it, I had a little tete-a-tete with him just a minute. I like this guy, he was so sweet. He said, you should talk to Al Capp. I said, I will. So Al Capp and I talk, and he goes, oh, golden song. I'm accepting the Man of the Year Award in Kansas City. How I remember this. So I said, oh, well, I'm really looking forward to seeing you, and da-da-da when you get here. And he said, well, I've got a lot to say to you. And I got David Merrick, who was the big producer at that time in Hollywood, in New York. So I ended up taking him and going. And I get my bags. I'm going to the World's Fair. And I go into this Park Avenue apartment. And I go in, and then they take me up. And then Eric, the butler, is waiting for me at the thing. And I'm at Park Avenue, and I'm going, oh, my God. I mean, this is we didn't come from very heavy-duty, a lot of means, right? We grew up in a dead-end street and lived in a half a house, okay? So anyway, so now I go in, and I'm sitting down, and this guy comes in, the butler comes in with a tray full of silver, and he said, Mr. Capp likes all his women to pour his tea. And I'm sitting there, I'm going, oh, my God. And now, where's Al Capp? Because he's not here. Oh, he'll be back. He'll be in a minute. So now I'm practicing, because the tea, it's silver, and I have to do this, and I'm by myself practicing how to do the tea when he walks in, and he barrels in, and he's got one leg. Oh, hi, Goldie. Oh, so nice to see you. And he's pulling his leg behind him. And I'm looking at him, and I'm going, are you kidding me? Oh, my God. Now, Al Capp was very famous. I'm sure a lot of you in here know this. Little Abner and, you know, Daisy May and Eagle Eye Flegel, and I actually did the show. But anyway, so I'm sitting there, and he comes, he says, let me slip into something more comfortable. Not kidding. Those are his words. And he comes down in this, like, silk robe. And he sits down next to me, and I'm going, how do I get out of here? Because I, believe me, been there before. So I looked at him, and I said, well, Mr. Capp, well, actually, really what I said, my parents really wanted me to marry a Jewish dentist, but I didn't do that because I really am a very hard worker, and I really want to be in the business, and I'm a dancer, and diarrhea of the mouth. But I wanted him to know that I was a really nice girl. At which point he says, that's all right, Goldie. Could you stand up, please? He said, and read for me. So I read. He said, you don't have to bring your voice up so high. This is TV. I went, okay. He said, I'm going to have people train you. You look great. Walk. He said, pretend you're an imbecile. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, just walk over there and just look at me like you're just an imbecile. So I remember I had a pink dress on, and it was over my knees. Naturally, we weren't quite in the knee place right there. It was 1964 or something. And so I'm taking my beads, because I didn't know how to look like an imbecile. So I took the beads, and I went, la, and I walked around, and I walked around. And then he said, that's great. Goldie, that's great. He said, you know, you could be Daisy May. At which point I thought, okay, this guy's full of, you know what. I was flat-chested. I was not Daisy May. So he said, I'd like to see your legs. And I thought, okay, I have a choice here. Do I show him my legs? As a dancer, I had legs up to here, okay? But I didn't want to pull my dress up to show him my legs. So I go over by the mirror, and I pull my legs up to just above my knee. Higher. A little bit above my knee. Higher. A little bit above my knee. I said, that's it. And I sat down next to him, and I'm going to tell you, he exposed himself. And he said, now come here and give me a little kiss. And I went, Mr. Capp, I will never get a job like this in my life. I will never do this. And he said, well, you'll never get anywhere in this business. And he said, I've had them all. And I went, okay, so I have to go now. So I looked at my watch, and I said, oh, my gosh, I'm late, and I have to take a cab, and I don't have any money. And he threw $20 at me. And he said, take a cab. And I ran out of there, and I took a cab. But this is one of the worst days ever. I took a cab. I went there. I had to dance. By the way, that's a whole other thing. I did 5 shows a night. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done. And the bartender friend of mine who I was seeing, he said, let me take you for a drink afterwards. We went to the Ondine Bar, and that was underneath the 59th Street Bridge. And then I had a few cocktails. I just had scotch. And we went and got in a car with his friend, and suddenly we're on West Side Highway, and a car pushes us off the road, and at 50 miles an hour, we headed into a light pole. I don't remember anything after that. And we just didn't look, I mean, like anybody could survive. And I was knocked out. I left my body. I watched them take me out. I watched them ask if I was alive. I woke up into the, you know, not the ambulance, into the hospital. And they gave me a taxi. I don't remember going home, and I was living by myself in a one-room apartment with a kitchenette and a lot of cockroaches. And so I went to sleep. I had a very bad concussion, and I woke up, and a phone call, and this kid, Peter Gale, picked up. He said, "You really effed up, didn't you, Goldie? You really, I told you to be nice to him." And I said, "Go back to Tuesday Weld and leave me alone." And I hung up the phone. I made it to the bathroom. I came back, and by God's will, I remembered his phone number because there was nobody else I could call. And I called him up, and I said, "Peter, I've been in a really, really bad accident, and there's nobody here, and I think I need to go back to the hospital." He comes. He brings with roses. He's crying his eyes out. He said, "I'm so sorry. I'm only 26. I'm being paid by Al Cap. I'm just a pimp for him," he said, "and I found you, and I'm so sorry." And he took me back to Roosevelt Hospital to make sure that I had a tetanus shot and so forth. So when you ask about that, the answer is yes.
Wow. And you didn't quit and go home. You decided
no,
to continue.
No, and I continue to like men. Because I think when you're out there and you're an innocent and you're accosted, whether it's in an elevator, whether it's anywhere, it was a challenge to look at men and trust them, but I do.
So let me ask you a question.
I also forgive them.
Not Al Cap.
Every day.
Not Al Cap.
No, I don't forgive Al Cap.
Okay.
I think he was a sick guy.
So, here's another issue.
Okay, that was a long story.
No, here's another issue. So you dance, you do laughing, you're a blonde,
mm-hmm.
you're doing comedy,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden you have Steven Spielberg directing you in Sugarland Express.
Mm-hmm.
You're now moving from comedy to drama.
Mm-hmm.
Are people accepting that? Are you having trouble getting...
They don't accept it.
They typecast you and they...
Right. They did... They you know, it's a good question in regard to how these movies are sold. So we did Sugarland Express. For any of you who have seen this movie, it's one of my favorite movies I've ever done.
One of Steven's best movies, by the way.
It is. And Steven even said that.
It is.
Because we watched
Excellent.
It together not long ago.
Excellent.
He said... So the thing is that it was a dramatic role. I mean, she was kind of crazy and kooky, but she was dramatic. And it was a great, great experience, and it was a really good movie. They sold it with me with a big smile on my face, with a gun in my hand, a teddy bear up my whatever, and it was the worst selling of a show. They wanted to bring in the comedy aspect of what people would expect. I mean, listen, I was just finished a few movies, so everyone thought that I was just still this light bubble, whatever, and this movie did very
poorly.
Even
though some of the great comedians like Andy Griffith and others who were comedians ended up doing really important serious films.
Yes, exactly.
They're
not remembered for that. And people want to feel good. If you have the gift to make people feel happy, if you are given that gift, it's not yours. That gift is not yours. It's a gift. So you honor it. And I've always felt that. So the idea of like saying, "Oh, I'm going to show everybody. I'm going to go out and I'm going to do, you know, Streetcar Named Desire and everybody's going to be blown away." I never personally had the wish to do that because I remember the first thing when I did Barbara Walters. And I was young. And she said to me, "First question, what is the biggest misconception of you?" And I couldn't answer the question, and it made me anxious. And the reason it did, and I didn't have the presence of mind at this, so I just cut it and said I had to go to the bathroom. So I cut it completely, right? But what I've later spoken to her about is that if I were to say to the audience, here's what you don't know about me, that is not fair. That's like saying to somebody, "Here's who I really am, and you don't know who I am." I want to honor the people that are there because whatever I gifted them with the gift I got made them happy. What am I going to say? You know, "I'm really a bitch," or "I'm really..." No, you want to do that. So it would make them wrong, is what I'm saying, okay? So doing all of that and giving that kind of talent, I never had the wish to just blow everybody's socks off with... I did it. You know when I did it? At 17 years old, I did that already. You only need to do it once.
Well,
I did it in Romeo and Juliet.
The fact of the matter is from my position, the hardest artist to find is a beautiful, funny woman, by far. Am I going to get in trouble. And I know this goes online, and I've gotten in trouble before when it goes online. But usually, unbelievably beautiful women, you being an exception, are not funny. And it's very funny, very difficult. Character women are funny. I think that's true with men, too. Character men are funny. Mm-hmm. But to find a woman who knows where the joke is, who is also unbelievably beautiful, and I figured it out.
What?
Because those women, from the time they are 1 year old, are told they're the most beautiful person in the room. From they're 5 years old, they're the most
beautiful. I totally agree. Oh. You can't, in other words, you're saying, Kirk says to me, well, it's just so great because you were an ugly duckling.
Well, you're not, but okay.
No, it doesn't mean that I was, but I wasn't ugly. I became one when I was going through puberty.
Well, you didn't think you were beautiful.
Did not. Okay. So I didn't have that personality. No.
But I know women and actresses who have been told they're beautiful. They win Miss Arkansas. And they don't ever have to get attention other than their looks.
Right.
So they don't tell a joke.
Right.
So in the history of the motion picture business, the number of beautiful, really beautiful women, a Lucille Ball, who's a beautiful woman, that are funny is impossible to find. Which is why
it's rare.
You have so many.
Carol Lombard was funny.
Exactly. And that's hard to find. Which is why you have so many gigantic movies, and one of which I screwed up by not doing. Anyway, so.
But the one I did love, the movie we did do together. Which,
yes, that was fun. That was fun. Now, the interesting thing to me is,
excuse me,
because I know you and I know how smart you are, that during this whole career, you've also had an intense desire for philanthropy, for creating a foundation, for helping children, with four children that you brought up, one of which I desperately wanted my son to marry. Oh, my God, I tried. I have a son, Kate's age, and they know each other from around.
I know, and they
and
still
And I kept
know
saying
each
to Eric, go, well, she's going to be a star. No, go ask her. She's so cute. Anyway.
She's great.
So she's also a great mother. Great mother. I'm a good father. That would have been a great combination.
Thank
anyway.
You.
But you have now, in the last 15 years or so, beyond all the other stuff you're doing, have in your own search for your identity, mm-hmm. your own dealing with what panic attacks they are, found a process mm-hmm. to make you feel better, and you've now introduced that into school systems.
Exactly.
So would you just describe that a little, because people here in this institution would be very interested
right.
in
that. Well, it's an interesting trajectory for somebody like me to go into this area. And, you know, and especially when you're going to schools and you're dealing with, you know, psychologists and positive psychologists and neuroscientists. The truth of the matter is that, you know, when everybody reaches a certain age, okay, you have to ask yourself the big question. What matters to you? And what is it in your life that you haven't done? And do you want to continue doing what you do? And what is going to inspire you for the next third act of your life? And I think a lot of us talk about it, think about it. A lot of us are tired of what we're doing. We'd like to be able to be inspired to do something different. And children have always been my philanthropy. After 9/11, I sat and I knit the American flag and I cried into it. That's the way I handled my grief for our country. But I also realized that our children were going to face a world that was never going to be the same again. A world that would be full of uncertainty, a world that would have a lot of anger and a lot of fear-based problems in it, and also our leadership would have to be constructed and built and taught in a different way in order to handle the kind of obstacles that we're going to be dealing with politically for many years to come. And the fact that children were going to be fearful, we were seeing then symptoms. And those symptoms were that kids were getting more aggressive, that there was bullying and uptake of bullying in the classroom, that our children becoming more depressed. There were more suicides, there were dropout rate was rising, and our children really were showing these signs of silent distress because stress of in itself is a killer. And with that, children were not able to learn. When a child is frenzied and when they're fearful and scared and uncertain, Not only does at-home issues where children are breaking up, the families are breaking up, but the world in which we live in affects our children just as it affects us as adults. In fact, their stress levels aren't seen as much, but they're seen through their actions. So I decided to put together a program, and this program was built on neurobiology. I asked the big question, why don't children know how their brains work? Why is it we ask them to use their brain, utilize their brain, ask them to pay attention when they don't even know what attention means, and really begin to wrestle with their emotions, which they have no clue on how to do? So therefore, we had kids opening up fire in classrooms. So at which point, that's what I brought together. Neuroscientists, positive psychologists, teachers, meditators, practitioners, and brought them together for almost about 18 months to sit down at Columbia University and their other universities together and create Mind Up. Mind Up is a 15-lesson program. It is a program that teaches children about their brain and how their emotional experiences can have connect to the brain. So it gives context to their emotion. So our children are able to discuss what their brain is doing. They know how to calm down their amygdala. So when they feel anxious or stressed or angry or fearful, they breathe and they focus 3 times a day in the classroom. What this has turned into is a global movement. We now have probably over 600,000 children doing the program. In 2016, end of 2016, we'll probably have about 1 million, hopefully more. We have the UK, the US, Canada, Hong Kong. We've just gone into Serbia, we're in Australia, and we've now moved into several schools in South America.
Did a lot of this come from your own experience, your travels in Africa, your travels in India,
yes,
your own dealing with anxiety before you have to go before an audience or before, even though you didn't do it till you were an adult, did that weigh on your thinking of how it could affect children?
This is a two-pronged answer. One is, I was never afraid of being in front of an audience, but I was afraid of certain things. I was afraid of uncertainties. I was afraid as a young girl that we were going to all die by the bomb. I believed that politically and geopolitically we have such difficult areas that children now realize because the news is on 24/7. They can get anything they want from porn to news, unmanaged, is that they have no way of organizing their own brain because their brain is not finished building until 24. So we're asking them to absorb and learn many more things than they have the capabilities of doing. So one of the things is my love of children and my wish for them to have a happy childhood, because they're not. They're stressed, they have too many books, there's too many studying, there's too much pressure. We cannot have their nature deficit disorder. Our children are not in nature anymore. They're not getting that. Their creativity is down, innovation is down. We have to inspire our children, and we're not. So that's the one end of it. The other end of it is that if we don't build leadership in our schools to deal with problem solving, we will not be able to move through to the next time period in a healthy way. I don't think there's a lot of hope for our world if we don't create leaders that have the ability to understand, see a problem from 100,000 feet up, take their ego out of it, take a good breath before they say something they shouldn't, become aware, more compassionate, and a great listener.
So what of these things... So what exactly does the teacher in the classroom do with this program? What happens in the classroom?
15 lessons. They come in the morning after school. When they get there, in the morning, the first thing they do is a brain break. The brain break comes with a bell. The bell is that these children sit quiet. They listen to the bell as long as they can, and then they take another minute for just following their breath. They calm down.
That's the brain break.
First thing.
3 minutes?
It's a 2.5 minute. So they sit there. They love it.
Breathing or thinking?
No, they breathe, and when they have thoughts that come in, they go back to their breath. So they're taught to let go of their thinking and come back to their breathing.
Right.
What this does is it enhances focused attention, because our children now have so much ADD, it's ridiculous, and they're all medicated. So we have over 13,000 million children medicated and growing every year. Okay, a kid looks out the window and he's disruptive, he's on medication. He could change the world. He could be another one that's... Do you know what I mean? He could have been the one, So this is what we're doing. So that's the first thing they do. Then they do a little lesson about the brain. They start learning, oh, there's the amygdala, there's this, and it's all up on the board. They start to understand what parts of the brain work and how we quiet down the bulldog, which is the amygdala, so they can think. So they understand the thinking brain and the reactive brain.
What is the amygdala?
The amygdala is there's two of them on either side of the brain. And these are the ones that, if you will, erupt. We call them the bulldog. These are the guard dogs. They're really important for us because they are the ones that are fight, flight, or freeze.
So that's aggression?
It's protection, which means danger. The brain goes like this. Cortisol goes like this. Adrenaline goes like this. There's a wolf coming. There's a thing. We are human. That's how we survive, right? Bad smell. Ooh, that means but what happens when those moments happen? A loud noise, accident, anything. That part of our brain, which is it's basically the limbic system. It's our emotional system. It's a very ancient system in our brain.
And they learn what this is.
Yes. So they know when they're afraid of tests. They know how to calm that down. Why do they know how to calm that down? Because they also learn about the executive function. That is what we call the wise old owl. That is the biggest part of our brain. It's bigger than any other animal. And we can think, analyze, ponder, make choices in a calm mind. That's what lights up when the amygdala starts to go down. You can breathe, focus, and quiet your amygdala. That's the bulldog. Get him back in the... What's number three?
Number one was the brain drain.
We're learning about this. So I'm just giving you the idea about the brain. So that's what the kids learn. Now we have mindful action. So we do mindful tasting. So these kids do a raisin, they do mindful tasting, they learn how to chew slowly, they learn about their digestion, they can put adjectives to it, it's all wrapped around their school, okay, their core, what they have to do in academics. So it's not an add-on, it's a changing the way the classroom functions. So they do mindful hearing and tasting, creating more creativity, giving them also more app time to train the brain to focus for longer periods of time. So it has various different aptitudes.
So it seems to me what you're saying is common sense and good, but you have some teachers in some school districts that say you're bringing religion, Buddhism.
I don't get that too much because we're brain-based. We're all brain-based. So what we've done is brain first. So when children know, now calming down the brain, we call them brain breaks. It's not religion. Every brain needs a break. Everybody's. And in order it rests the brain. So it can get started up again to think again. It's all about neurobiology. So it's all research-based. We've researched our program over and over again. Our children have become 80% happier, more optimistic. Our optimism for children creates a better learning environment for them.
Yeah, because I saw some research that looked awesome.
Yeah, it's exciting. So we have, now, it's like any other program. We want to get this in every school in America. And yes, I'm talking with congressmen and we're meeting with them and there's a huge movement going on. But we continue to just get schools after schools after schools. We are in some schools here, which is fantastic, and hopefully we'll get in more schools here in the Valley. It's not hard. It is not hard. When we do perspective taking, we do gratitude journals. These kids are telling you what they're grateful for. What happens to the brain when you say I'm grateful for something is amazing. Dopamine is emitted from the brain. Serotonin lights up. These are things in the brain that make you feel good.
So better than me asking questions about this, we have time for questions either about Mind Up or anything else we've talked about or anything you can think of.
Or any of the other guys that, you know, it's always that.
All right, this lady right here is getting a microphone. Introduce yourself and then ask the question.
Thank you. My name is Peggy Wise, and I'm the founder of a community music school in Chicago who has just initiated in the last year a pilot in social and emotional health that we link with music and learning music. And it's not where you get to, but how you get there. And I'm wondering how we could collaborate with your wonderful work.
Well, we have our program, you know, goes into schools, and our program obviously has a price to it. Okay, so we go to the places that can't afford it, and we support them. But for those schools that can't afford it, then part of that money goes back into creating more product. So we would definitely be able to work with you. I'm a great believer, obviously, in music. Changes the brain tremendously. So if you have a card and you can bring it here, I can send it to them and someone can call you from the office. Our office is in Miami.
Next question, right down here, front left.
Congratulations. That's great work. Yeah.
Hi, Goldie.
Hi.
The movie Inside Out, Pixar's movie, deals very well with what you're saying. So that's an amazing piece of work that goes with what you're doing. You sound so fully committed to this. Have you given up showbiz? And would you talk a little bit about ageism in the movies and TV?
Oh, good question. You know, it's real. Okay, and one of the things is really, once again, you know, we'd like to think we're all clumped together, but every actor and actor, you know, is its own person, right? So there's no group effort there. On a personal level, I never wanted to be the person that had to knock on a door to get a movie. It just didn't happen that way. So I decided to produce, right? I figured, let me produce movies. I can make movies for other people. I can make movies for me. So it was exciting. Great time. Very creative. But I also took charge of my life, okay? The other part of it is that when you get to a certain age, you have to make a decision for yourself. Is that what you want to do? If you want to get old in the industry and you want to be able to play maybe a few parts that come along now and then, or what else in life interests you? I was the person that the last movie I did was Banger Sisters. Banger Sisters, it was a great out. It was a movie that I had done that, you know, I got a nomination for Golden Globe, it was awesome, and we were in the black in the first weekend. So a movie with women of a certain age, which of course in First Wives Club it was like everybody took less money because God forbid it's women of a certain age, it's not going to do anything. Everybody ended up making a ton of money, and you know, we went back to make the movie again and they said, well, we'll give you the same amount of money you got before. I said, you know, I think I'll rather do the movie I'm getting less money for and save my integrity. So in terms of that, that was Banger, and we did really well. And then I moved up to Vancouver for Wyatt because he wanted to play hockey. And I left the town and and created this program. Why? Because I am not the kind of person that is going to sit around waiting for anything. And at that time, in my 50s or whatever, I decided that I was going to change the things that I wanted to do. There's nothing worse than being a pawn on a board. And when you get older, unless that is your trajectory of life and that's what you want to do, then God go with you. But it was never what I wanted to do, right? So I wrote books and created things, and I'm still creating parent programs, and I'm in the middle of writing another book. So this excites me.
By the way, let me just say something about aging as well. Goldie and I both share something that we have to keep remembering. We were the benefit of enormous success in youth. On the other side of it, it's 18 and 20, and she's a giant star. I'm the president of Paramount at 30. I'm the chairman of Disney at 42. America does criticize a lot for the ageism issue. On the other hand, there's a lot of opportunity for a lot of young people to be very successful very early, and it's only if you get spoiled and think, oh, I've had it, I'm over at 40 or 50 or 60 or 70, is ageism affect you? So I'm very happy that in this country you don't have to be, you know, 72 before somebody recognizes you, as in some other countries. I'm very happy that swimmers peak at 14 or 18. I mean, it's okay. Anyway, I don't know why.
It is the way it goes, though. Yes.
Let me see. Let me do one over here, then I'll come back here. And the red, because I can see red easier than I can see shirtless. Or sleeveless. Not shirtless. Sleeveless. Armless.
That was good.
Right.
Hi, I'm Ann Kaiser. I wanted to find
out. Can we have the mic up?
Could you hold
here?
The mic to your mouth, Annie?
Oh, sorry. I'm Ann Kaiser. I wanted to find out if you knew or had tried any applications of the MindUp program with the autistic community.
Yeah.
Because I'm very interested in that process, and it just seems as if it would be a natural fit in order to calm down that anxiety level.
Yes. Excuse me. Yes, we have. And what I'm working on now is Mind Up for Autism, because I think it's its own bucket. We have tried our program, and a lot of our children are responding unbelievably well. These are children with mild, a mild autism, and they're in the classroom, and the stories are unbelievable. I mean, unbelievable. Because one of the kids couldn't stop shaking his hands and was very nervous, and one of the boys in the classroom said, could we do our circle for breathing and mind up at that point? They call it the mind up, which has become a verb, which I love, right? Mind up has become a verb. I'm doing my mind up. So it calmed him right down, and he was able to take his test. So it was a great thing with empathy with other children in the classroom, which we teach, and also the idea that he was able to manage his reactivity.
Over on this side, lady with a black sleeve.
Black sleeves.
Hi, I'm Samantha. I'm a mindfulness-based psychotherapist, recently graduated. And my question is, are there the teachers that actually do the mind up in the classroom, and is there a training that they go through?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is it like something that you can sign up for?
Okay. We have trainings in schools. So we usually do a full school training, which means that we go in and we train the entire school. We don't try to do the grade. So we go into elementary schools. We're now moving into high school, by the way, which I'm really excited about our curriculum. It's quite different and it's exciting. But in terms of this, yes, we do have that. I'm now also working on actual here. We had like a whole regional training that anybody can go to. And I think that's also a wonderful way to be able to give the program to others who want it. Even if you're a teacher and you're in sixth grade or fifth grade, you can do it yourself, right? But you can get a certificate from a two-day training here. So that's what we're working on, and that's the way we do it. We have trainers that come in. They train anywhere from 30 to 60 teachers at once, and they go through rigorous training, and they come out, and then we go back again, and we work with them again, and that's how it works over the year.
Now back to the middle. Lady right in front of me.
So you didn't marry your Jewish dentist, and you didn't have that...
Wait, no, yeah, this is too good. You got to wave the microphone.
Really? So you didn't marry the Jewish dentist, and you didn't have that, quote, normal life. So I'm curious, is there any aching for the path not followed now that you had this big, huge Hollywood life? Did you ache for what you didn't get?
No, I didn't know what I was going to get. So the difference is that looking backwards has never been anything I've ever done. Everything that I've done up to each point has been, for better or worse, taking me to the next step. So I've never ached from the past. I only ache to see my parents again, and I can never do that. So I don't. I cherish all of it.
Why do parents want their children to marry Jewish dentists? How about a Jewish cardiologist?
Because they were... Exactly.
question is... all right. Right here in the red, down front.
Here, you.
And next one's over here.
Yeah, sorry.
Harvey McKay, what's the difference between the children today versus 15 to 20 years ago, and the difference between the parents raising those children today and 15 and 20 years ago?
It's a long question answer, but I would say if we were to go back to the time that I remember, there wasn't as much divorce. So children were not subject of divorce parents, number one. Number two, I didn't walk to school, and neither did my friends, with books on their back to where they had, sawed-on scoliosis. We walked to school. We were unafraid in our neighborhoods. We never locked our doors, and we had a lot of family and a lot of friends in the neighborhood. So there was a feeling of safety that we had in that time period. And our teachers were, they didn't look at me. For instance, I had learned disability. I mean, I think I have mild dyslexia. So I didn't do very well in school, and I didn't read very well, and I was in the purple balls.
Helped you in laughing.
What?
Helped you in laughing.
helped me a lot because I got the words wrong. And the good news is my parents' sense of humor, so I laughed, right? So, but in terms of that kind of thing, that's where I was. So, you know, when I was on the Purple Balls, I was excited because it was the only, I was the only one in it, you know, and my mom was like, I wanted to tell her. She found out the reason I was in it because I was so happy, but I wasn't reading well. And then I used to pick up things and say, they didn't get mad at me, and I didn't feel stupid, and I didn't feel like I needed pills, and I didn't think I needed this. And then I would color all the fruit yellow, and the fruit was all different colors. And the teacher would say to me, well, why did you do that? And I'd say, because I like yellow. And nobody said, oh, she has a problem, or whatever. So, and I signed all my papers, Love Goldie. And that, that was like, it was all okay. I wasn't weird. So today, we have a much more complex world. I mean, we're full of fear. We've got television 24/7. I'm not sitting on my lap and watching Kukla, Fran, and Ollie that I did with my dad in more innocence. Our children are seeing things over and over again. They have access to sexual, you know, videos and things online and things that they should never be seeing that their brains can't function, they can't handle. We have too much permissiveness. We've lost the family unit, which I think is extremely important. We've lost teachers' enthusiasm for teaching. There's so many problems we're dealing with today, and it breaks my heart. So
I think we have run out of time, and it's a good place to stop on Love Goldie and Goldie. Thank you very much.
That was a taped discussion from the 2015 Aspen Ideas Festival featuring Goldie Hawn and Michael Eisner speaking about Hawn's career and her work with children and mindfulness. You can find the talk on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Corporate support for Aspen Public Radio's coverage of the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival broadcasts comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisory firm that works with individuals, corporations, and foundations, with offices in Aspen and Denver. More at obermeyerwood.com. I'm Marcy Criven, and thanks for listening. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale.